every diet. Thank you in advance for being on tech tonight. It's a really important part of the evening, so couldn't be done without having her diet. Welcome everybody. Welcome to Desert Island Discs tonight, or Desert Island Retreat, I should probably call it. And tonight, we've got my dear friend, Sacha Joshi, who, as we all know, is our current chair, but not for long. So she's been chair of this, the SBC, the centre of the universe, since 2018. And tonight I've invited her to choose her 8 favourite tracks, music tracks, a book or books, and a luxury item that she's going to be cast away with on our imaginary desert island. So, as I said, Sacha Joshi has been chair since 2018. Yeah, he took over from Machadasa. And, it's been a pretty tricky time, hasn't it? You steered us through the COVID pandemic, which was pretty stressful, busy. But also a time of expansion, actually. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly since COVID, we've had a real time of expansion at the centre. Mm-hmm. Lots more young people coming along, lots more people in general coming along to the centre. And I think that's really been driven by you at the helm. And obviously as the centre grows, the job of the chair grows, gets busier and more complex. So I think Sacha Joshi has served us incredibly well. Mm-hmm. Sort of saying goodbye to us, not forever, but I'm having a bit of a rest. So I was just asking Sacha Joshi earlier, how long have you worked for the centre of the universe? 15 years, nearly 15 years, And you started out as nature convener, I think, didn't you? Yeah, and then took over as chair, deputy chairman chair. That's just amazing. All the service that you've given to Sheffield Buddhist Centre. I think Sacha Joshi is also known for her brilliant mind. Really, really good mind. Yeah. Good mind. And she gives really clear Dharma talks. She's a bit embarrassing. She gives really, really clear Dharma talks. Very accessible Dharma talks. She's also a very, very good friend to lots of people. A good, loyal friend. And she's been one of the main people at the Women's Community since it moved into its current building. Yeah. Since 2016?
2016. Yeah, the 10. Women's Community, and I think it'll be 10 again.
So a steward of the Women's Community as well. So lots and lots to rejoice in. To celebrate. And tonight we're going to hear some more details about Sacha Joshi's life and how she came to be sitting here now. Yeah. So, you were born in Canberra, Australia, 1962, and given the name Nikki Edmonds, and you were the eldest child of 3 girls, and your dad was a diplomat for the Australian government. So, tell us a bit about your early life. What was it like?
We moved around a lot. Mm-hmm. We moved around really a lot. So, first of all, when I was 6 weeks old, my parents moved from Australia, where I was born, to the Lebanon. And my dad did a course in Arabic. I don't know how it was for them, because they were quite young and high up in a mountain with a little baby. I don't think it was that easy for them, actually. And I think, although it sounds really glamorous, the whole diplomatic thing and all the travel and stuff, I think it was pretty tough for them, actually. Quite soon they had 3 little kids, moving a lot, neither particularly suited for the roles that they found themselves in. So my dad was very shy. My mum always said it'd been better if he'd been a gardener, he'd have been happier. Mm-hmm. So being, you know, like being a diplomat wasn't his kind of best way of living. Mm-hmm. And my mum had to be a diplomat's wife in the 60s, and she was far too intelligent and educated for that. You know, it was like, yeah. So they found it quite challenging, actually. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, but you ended up moving to Manchester.
Yeah. So I think when I was about 6 or 7, my dad was in Nairobi. We were all in Nairobi in Africa, which I do remember. So some of the places we went to, I don't remember at all. But I do remember Nairobi. And I think there were a number of reasons, but my dad decided to stop working in that job, partly because I'd have had to go to boarding school in Australia. So I'm really grateful for them, actually, that they made that decision, because that would not have been... That would have been a really painful thing, you know, and other reasons as well. But anyway, so they ended up moving to the UK, where I stayed with my granddad in London for a while, and then my dad got a job in Salford, and we moved to Manchester.
Mm. Okay, so what was that like?
It was a complete shock. So I think it was just like, we moved in the winter, it was really cold. It was just a culture shock for all of us.
Yeah, sure.
Even though I was like, no, I spoke English, I suppose with an Australian accent, and it was just, the culture was really different. Like, I remember my first day at primary school, a boy said to me, do you support United or City? And I didn't know what a United was or a City was, and I just had to guess, and luckily I guessed United. So that's I support Manchester United. But it's just like, you know, my understanding of what was going on quite often was pretty limited, actually. But I think I soon lost my accent and soon that fitted in.
And you've got some good memories. So maybe we should hear the first track. Do you want to tell us a bit about the first track?
Okay, so I've chosen a song, I think it was Paul...
Peter, Paul and Mary.
And it's Puff the Magic Dragon, which is such a favourite of mine. Sad, so I hope you're all ready for that. I just really remember, so my dad loved music, and he had like a really great gramophone, like this wonderful shiny brown wooden gramophone. But we had this really great thing that younger people might not have come across, where you could play singles, and you could like, it's kind of a plastic thing, you had these singles, and you could layer them all up, and then drop them down one after another, which me and my sisters just loved. So, Puff the Magic Dragon.
Puff the Magic Dragon, live by the sea, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Little Jackie Paper loved that rascal Pup, and brought him strings and sealing wax and other fancy stuff. Oh, Pup the Magic Dragon lived by the sea, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Pup the Magic Dragon lived by the sea, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Together they would travel on a boat with billowed sail. Jackie kept a lookout perched on Pup's gigantic tail. Kings and princes would bow whene'er they came. Pirate ships would lower their flags when Pup roared out his name. Oh, Pup the Magic Dragon lived by the sea, and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Pup the Magic Dragon lived by autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. A dry wagon lives forever, but not so little boys. Painted wings and giant rings make way for other toys. One gray night it happened, Jackie Paper came no more. And Puff, that mighty dragon, he ceased his fearless roar. His head was bent in sorrow, green scales fell like rain. Puff no longer went to play along the cherry lane. Without his lifelong friend, Puff could not be brave. So Puff, that mighty dragon, sadly slipped into his cave. Oh, Puff, the magic dragon, lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called Honolulu. Puff, the magic dragon, lived by the sea and frolicked in the autumn mist in a land called
tell us a bit about your school life and your teenage life.
So I lived in a suburb of Manchester, and I think my dad is a university lecturer and my mum a teacher. What can I say? So primary school. And then I got a free place to a private school. In those days, you could get these free places if you pass those exams and all that. And went to a private school. And I'm glad I went to that school, but I wasn't brilliantly happy there. I don't think I'd been brilliantly happy at any school, actually. But, I think my family, there was a lot of things that still stay with me. There was a lot of talking about different ideas, books, lots of books in the house. A lot of going out to nature. My dad used to take us for walks most weekends. Lots of animals, pets, great cats and dogs. I don't know how my parents did it, really, particularly my mum, who did a teacher training course, then worked as a teacher, bringing up three children, and was always making things. I've still got cardigans that she knitted, a quilt, things, just so many things that she seemed to make as well as doing all that. Oh, and then she did an open university course in psychology as well. So it's actually, so both of them. And my dad, quite interestingly, like, for instance, he bought me a copy of, I grew up near Stockport, and there's these big bridges there that the railway goes across. And during Victorian times, I think it was, there were lots of poor people used to sleep under them. And my dad bought me a book by Frederick Engels that was all about, Frederick Engels was really influenced by the plight of those people living under the arches. So, he was just really kind of bringing all those ideas and things into the house. But I think, I was always looking for something more. You know what I mean? It was like, even though that was something, there was a lot of such great things happening, there was something about I kind of yearned for more connection. I suppose a sense of something more magical or holy, I guess. So I did for a while become a Christian. I can't remember it all, but I know that in my teens, I went to this, some friends, we went to a local community centre and there was a band playing. And they played Your Love Is Lifting Me High, and I've never been lifted before, which I didn't choose actually from my song. But anyway, it so swept me away. They said, if you want to come around, come around and see us at the back, please do. So I did. And I didn't realise they were a Christian band, and they had us all praying. My paternal grandparent had been a missionary in India and Pakistan, my family wasn't that religious at that particular time. My mum later became Quaker. But at that time, religion wasn't that much part of our active life. So I think they were a bit surprised, my parents, when I started going to a Christian youth club. Which I did really enjoy for a while. in the end, it was a kind of classic thing about, I just thought, I can't get my head around a God that allows her to be suffering in the world like this. It just didn't make sense. So I stepped back from that.
So is now a good time to play your next song, your sort of teenage song?
Yeah. So kind of in the classic teenage way, I was full of a certain kind of anger and wish for connection. And this song kind of summed that up, I guess, or it spoke to me.
So that was the jam with Start. Bit of a darling message there.
There is, isn't there? A bit of it, maybe all of it.
perhaps not loving with a passion.
I would hate them.
What you give is what you get. So you told me a funny story about when you were a teenager, your fashion, you know, how to fit in with all the different.
Oh, okay. So I suppose I was a teenager just at the cusp between hippies and punks. And I used to like go out wearing, I can't remember exactly, but I used to wear like a long shirt and jeans that were ripped. And like if I saw a punk coming, some punks coming, I'd put on a particular, I can't remember what I did. And then if there were hippies coming, I'd kind of get on my scarf. So it was kind of like sort of thing.
Just with a bit of accessorising.
A bit of accessorising.
Very good. So after school you went to study psychology at Manchester?
Yeah, before that I had a year in Greece, looking after two little boys. I went and I studied psychology, and I did that for a few reasons. I think one was influenced by my mum doing her psychology open university degree, but also because I'd had, since I was probably about 15 or 16, so I had a real wish to know what made people happy. And I thought, oh, if I study psychology, they'll know what makes people happy. Mm-hmm. Now, back in the early 80s, they didn't know. It wasn't even a question. I think it is now, the psychologist, looking at Neil Matthew, but I don't think it then it wasn't. So I was a bit disappointed, like in this kind of quest I had to find out, you know, what would make people happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite, I was quite I suppose, politically motivated at that time, so quite involved in women's politics. I seem to remember loads of just like sitting in the road, not particularly any good reason. And a few times having sit-ins as well in the university for very good reasons. And actually towards the end of my time there, it was the miners' strike. And it was a particular time, actually. It was a very grim time. And I did a bit of, like, collecting food and going to picket lines and stuff. But actually, towards my in my last year, I did do a bit more work. So I was doing less of that and actually working a bit harder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and then after you left university, you immediately went into a career?
No, so it was 1984, and it was, like, the worst recession has been ever since, like, in our lifetime, actually, apparently. Even more recently, it hasn't been like that. I just didn't even think of getting a job. And I thought I'd maybe become an educational psychologist. But to do that, I needed to do a teacher training course. And I had teachers going on both sides of the family, back generations. And I just thought, I can't do it. I don't want to be a teacher. So I kind of just procrastinated about doing my form and doing my PGC and got involved instead with video making, which at that time was very different from how it is now. Like, you can just put it on your phone. But at that time, to do video, you had to have these massive, great cameras and these huge, great bits, things you had to carry around with you. And I particularly got involved because there's an area in Manchester called Hume that at that time is really run down, with all these flats that had been built with great plans but had gone badly wrong. And quite a few people were like either renting them out or in squats there. And I came across a flat with a family in that had all these cockroaches, literally so many cockroaches. It was awful, just falling off the roof, just falling. It was really bad. And I got involved in making a video to kind of get, you know, to talk about that, to kind of do stuff, try and change things. And that led me into, well, I heard that in Sheffield there was this women's film co-op, which in fact Chrissy is here, was a founder member of. And I didn't know Chrissy then. And I thought, well, we could do that in Manchester. So I bought an advert in this shop called Grassroots, because this is all pre-internet, so you couldn't get hold of them. So I bought an advert in the Grassroots bookshop. And I thought, oh, some women all could turn up who know about filmmaking. But seven of us turned up and none of us knew about filmmaking at all. Mm-hmm. But we kind of went ahead and set up as a co-op making videos. And we did get, we got some work from the city council. We got some work teaching other people how to do videos and stuff. And we made various things and gradually we learned. I went on a course as well. I mean, and then that lasted for a few years, which was quite good, but after a while it wasn't actually. We got what was called the enterprise allowance for a year, which meant we had a bit of money. After that stopped, we weren't making enough money to pay ourselves.
But you were enjoying life?
Yeah, I was quite into clubbing and all that at that time. So in Manchester at that time, it's called I don't know if people know the Hacienda. Okay, so kind of before the Hacienda went into all the kind of Summer of Love stuff, there was like New Order and all that kind of factory stuff. So I used to go there and I felt really cool because I knew the guys that did the projections. My girlfriend worked in the bar, used to give me all free cocktails. And things like some of the films we made got shown there. And yeah, so it was a particularly exciting time. Hence the next record. But we're not having all of it, are we? No.
So should we have the next one? Some of you will recognise this, I'm sure. long intro, isn't it?
It's a long intro.
So that was Blue Monday by Computer. Classic dance track. So you were cool, being cool, hanging out at the Hacienda.
I thought, felt like it was cool, so. I got a government kind of scheme job at the Museum of Science and Industry, which was really interesting in Manchester for about 9 months. And I got to make like a slideshow about the history of aviation, which was great. And I got to dress up as a little cat and stand on a steam train. I thought it was maybe time to move away from Manchester because actually it wasn't maybe the healthiest of lives. And I got a job as a community video worker working in York. And community video, it's like being a community artist. So working with groups to help them make their own videos. So I moved to York, where I had quite a few friends already actually. And did various projects like with a group of young people had diabetes, that was called Swings and Roundabouts, we made a video, and with a group of people with learning disabilities, which was, had a lot of fun doing that. So I did that for a few years. Mm.
And you made your own film as well?
Oh, yes. I made, with a friend, Jackie, we made a film called Cream Soda, on 16mm film, and we got a grant from Yorkshire Arts to make that. And it's basically a story about two women who are travelling around. Well, one in a lovely VW camper van. And she's kind of going to different parts of Britain looking for ponds of dolphins. And she picks up a hitchhiker. And it's about what happens between them.
Okay, that's what the film's about. Yes. The next track is from the film, but do you want to tell us about the award ceremony?
Oh, yes. So, it wasn't an award ceremony, but the film did get into... the film's kind of okay, but not brilliant. But and it did get into quite a lot of festivals. And some of them I didn't get invited to, which is a shame, like San Francisco, when I really wanted that. Did go to Norwich. But it was shown at the London Lesbian and Gay Film Festival. And my friend actually had made the film with couldn't come, but I went down on my own. And it was just such a weird night, because first of all, there was this drinks party with all these kind of people who I really recognised at Julian. People, filmmakers, I knew who they were, kind of drinking all these drinks, and I was really shy. And then my film was shown, which was amazing to have it shown on the big screen, and then at the BFI. But then I got lost on the way back, because at that time there was this kind of underground homeless people kind of like a place where people lived, they'd take
on the South Bank.
On the South Bank, yes, so the BFI's on the South Bank. Mm. And a whole load of homeless people had started living in the basements, so in the kind of, anyway, not very beautiful places. So it's just the juxtaposition of those two worlds I found just really... such a strong impression on me.
So the next track is from...
It's from the film.
And it's also a Manchester band.
No, from Northern Ireland.
Are they?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Not a Manchester.
I run the risk of losing.
rich. So what happened after your filmmaking in New York? Where did you go next?
I came to Sheffield. I came to do a postgraduate course in fiction filmmaking at Salter Lane, actually, at first. So I was kind of about 30 by then, and I found out I was really old. Because now, obviously, that seems quite young. But it was a great year. I watched a lot of films. I played about doing filmmaking and stuff. It was a good year. I think I also realised, I could just see that there was a particular woman on the course who just had such a flair for filmmaking. And I just thought, whoa, she's really got something that I haven't. It's like, I thought I could have been like a really, steady soap filmmaker. Do you know what I mean? It's like I can do shots. But this woman, she just had this flair. And I just thought, I don't know if this is what I want to do with my life anymore. Do you know what I mean? The amount of effort and energy that goes and how much you have to put into if you're going to try and make films with your life.
Mm.
So although I really enjoyed that year and I'm glad I did it, I suppose in a way it was very useful because it's just like I just thought, actually, I don't want to do this. Mm. Oh, yeah, I had a really good dream at that time. So I had this dream that I was in this kind of sound studio, like a massive thing with this massive roof. And there's like stars projected onto the roof, really beautiful. And then they opened the roof, opened it up, and you could see the real stars beyond it. And they were far more beautiful than the projections. So something about real life being much more beautiful. Perhaps the films make that.
So what happened?
So then I needed to get some money. I needed to earn a living. So I got a job in Birmingham, at Birmingham Centre for Media Arts. It's a shame that Andy's not here because he's got a cold, but I always say Andy Sam interviewed me for the job that I got in Birmingham. And it's an mixed blessing in some ways because actually I moved to Birmingham, I didn't have any friends, I didn't know anybody. And what had happened is there'd been two small arts organisations that had been closed down by funders. Some people made redundant and some people kept on. And then they'd been forced into this new organisation, Birmingham Centre for Media Arts, that I became the director of in my early 30s. And it was a bit of a shock because it was very dysfunctional. People weren't talking to each other. If someone rang the doorbell, no one would go answer it. Just And I got quite stressed, life really difficult, and I wondered what to do about it. So I thought, oh, well, people say that meditation is good for me. So I went along to a meditation class in Birmingham. I went to a couple of different ones, and they ended up going to one run by the NKT, the Yucatan tradition, and in a little church hall thing, and the nun came in and sat the front very formally, and then she started to talk about the Dharma, and I just thought, oh, this makes such sense. It's like I've been searching through politics, I've been searching through kind of film or media arts or kind of community arts work, looking for something that made sense. And then there was this just fantastic description of the human condition that she started to talk about. So I love that. Then we did some meditation, and I was just like, could not do it. So my mind was so busy. Meditation didn't work for me, but the Dharma just really got me in. And before long, I'd kind of got quite involved with the NKT. And they bought a house, a big house. They took on quite a big project. They wanted me involved because I was young, and it just was quite a lot of pressure on me, actually. And I started a new relationship with somebody, and was going out. He's a climber, a walker, and I was going out to really wild countryside, and just like the pull of like them wanting too much from me, the pull of the wild, I guess. And also the NKTs at that time, there was a Guardian article about them, and I thought, oh, they must be really dodgy. <There's a Guardian> And then I went to see the Dalai Lama, and they were picketing the Dalai Lama. And it was just, the Tibetan politics was just too much for me. So I stepped right back from the NKT for some years. And then after a few years, somebody at work said, oh, why don't we go? Because I thought of myself as a Buddhist. Do you know what I mean? I thought, I am a Buddhist. And actually, it was really hard leaving one sangha. It was a big thing to do it. But after a few years, someone said, oh, why don't we go to the FWBO, as it was then. And I went along to a house in Birmingham where Vajragupta was teaching plants, and started very slowly to get involved with the Birmingham sangha, but much more slowly.
Shall we talk about your next track?
Which I can't remember what it is. Okay. Yeah, so this is a Nina Simone song. So I've always loved Nina Simone. Really hard to know which one to choose. I think I've got a few options, haven't I? You kind of thought this one, Mr. Bojangles. And it's partly because my dad loved it. Oh, I will get upset. Let's listen to the song.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. Worn out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt and baggy pants, the old soft shoe. He jumped so high, jumped so high. Then he lightly touched the ground. I met him in a cell in New Orleans. I was down and out. He looked at me to be the eyes of age as he spoke right out. Life. He laughed and slapped his leg a step. Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles. Said his name, Bojangles, then he danced the lick across the sand. He grabbed his pants, a better stance. Oh, how he jumped up high. He clicked his heels. He let go alive. Let go alive. He stood up and shook back his clothes all around. He danced for those at minstrel shows and county fairs throughout the South. He spoke with the tears of 15. How his dog and he traveled about. His dog up and died. He just up and died. After 20 years, he still grieved. Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, and
he said, I dance now at every chance and honky tonks for drinks and tips. But most of the time I spend behind these county bars, he said, I drink a beer. He shook his head. As he shook his head, I heard someone respectfully ask, please, Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles, Mr. Bojangles.
Yeah, so it's quite a challenging time for my family because my dad got dementia when he was 58. So he'd been from being, you know, a man of ideas and, yeah. So and he lived for a long time with dementia as well, about 17 years. And it was just, yeah, it's just, I won't go into it, but it was just very challenging for my mum, for all of us.
You were getting more involved with FWBO?
I was sort of, yeah, getting involved with them. And then I realised I felt like I wanted to settle down somewhere. Mm. I didn't want to settle down in Birmingham. So I remembered how much I loved Sheffield. And I heard it was quite a good Buddhist centre in Sheffield. So I thought I'll move to Sheffield. And I got a job at the Community Media Association. So that was really good. And I moved to Sheffield. It did take me nearly a year to find the centre in Broomhill. At least twice I went looking for it in the car, kind of like, just anyway. Is it more about me and my state of mind? And eventually I did find it, and started going along. I remember Murga from Matty. I think Midani was away on your ordination retreat, actually, when I first started going. But then Matty was very much there. Yeah, I think I got more and more interested. And then I remember very clearly reading the booklet, Taste of Freedom, you know, Banta's talk. And I just thought, this makes such sense to me. This is what I want to do. I want to get ordained into this. I suppose I should become a mitra first. My commitment was kind of made from then. I think because I'd known that I was a Buddhist looking for a sangha, as it were, looking for a place. It was like, So I think the way that he wrote and talked about, articulated the Dharma, I just thought, this is what I'm looking for. Mm. I had to make a bit of a choice, though, because I had started, I'd done some dinghy sailing as a child. And when I started going out with Mike, and we'd done a lot of kind of, he did a real keen climber. I quite like climbing, but not as much as he did. But I remember how much I loved sailing, and I thought I'd really like to learn to sail. So I started doing a little bit of kind of courses that you do to do sailing. And I realised that I couldn't do both. I couldn't train for ordination because I couldn't afford the retreats and the courses and the time off work as well. It was one or the other. So I decided to train for ordination, but I had to make this kind of little bargain with myself, which was, in 5 years' time, if you don't like the Buddhism, you can go back to the sailing. But I never have come back. But it's interesting because there's something in common with both of them, which kind of called to me. I think it's like the idea of freedom and kind of like the vastness of the ocean with sailing, this idea that I had the skills, I could sail anywhere, and the kind of openness of that. And then the sense of the vastness of the Dharma, and that if I knew what I was doing, it kind of opened up something I would never come to the end of in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and how was your ordination process?
I think I was really fortunate because a lot of things just fell into place for me. Just so, for instance, Punyamala became a private preceptor just a year or two before I needed a private preceptor. The whole kula system just started. I had one kula, it just started there. It's like I was ordained at Akashavana, the second year of Akashavana. It just felt like I had a really easy ride because there was things were just happening there for me as I wanted them, if you saw what I mean.
Yeah.
So on the whole, I mean, obviously, it has its challenges, anyone's ordination training, but I mostly really appreciated it. I feel very grateful.
You said something about your first kula, saying something about, well, you've obviously got the Dharma and you're getting a connection with the Buddha, but what about the Sangha?
That's right, and I said, what about the Punyamala as well? And maybe I'm answering my kula as well. So, well, what about the Sangha? Yeah, it was interesting because at that time I thought, I have quite a few friends, I'm quite fine, why would I want to? And interestingly, since then, I've just gone through such a massive turnaround, so much so that, like, I think the Sangha has been for the last 15 years my main practice. You know, it's like, without a Sangha, you can't do it. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, it's impossible. So, really interesting, just, what a turnaround I've had.
So you went to Akashavana in 2008,
yeah.
I think. Tell us a bit about your ordination retreat. What was it like?
It was mixed. It was challenging, but very challenging at times, actually, because the weather was just terrible. And it rained. It was cold and it rained. And interestingly, this year, actually, I was talking to a few people who'd been on the team of that retreat. And they were going, yeah, it was. I also, it was my kind of whatever. You know, my mind was like creating, and I know that was a particularly just so hard for everybody because Akashavana was not, yes, it was set up for the heat of the Spanish summer, not for freezing cold and endless rain. You know, it was really grim for me at times, but then, after the ordinations, the private preceptors left. And it's like the sun came. Oh, well, they had to be like, it was really difficult for them to leave because of floods and all this kind of stuff. Anyway, after that, the sun came out. The vultures who'd been missing, because they were beautiful vultures at Akashavana, they came down. And then we had about, what for the next number of weeks were, of just glorious weather. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And it's like, I had a little bit of a kind of wobbly thing around joining the order on the day of my public ordination. But since then, I haven't regretted it at all. It's like, luckily, I seem to get the wobbles then. And since then, it's been, I've just been really, really, really grateful to be in the order.
Do you want to tell us about your name?
Yes, so my name, Satchajyoti, means light of truth, which I loved straight away. I didn't know that there's a really clever system where people can't get the same name. So I spent a bit of time in silence before I heard everybody else's name going, please, don't anybody else have the same name? I was like, if they have, I don't care about all this bodhisattva stuff. I'm having it. So I should just get another one. I did feel like that was my name.
But ordained, you're back in Sheffield working for the India Dharma Trust?
Well, I kept working for the Community Media Association and then like a consultancy company after that. But I started working to work for the Dharma, so I started up working as a fundraiser for the India Dharma Trust. And so that leads into a little bit of music.
That's good.
So I... part of that, at one point, I took some of the Indian Dharma Charanis on a little tour to Blackburn, actually. And in Blackburn, I remember they'd stayed in somebody's house, and I went there, and he played this song, and it just blew me away in a particular way. So let's have this song. It's quite long. You have to just really get into a meditative state.
Yeah.
Aleko. I could have had a lot of Aleko in the songs, actually. Yeah, I went to see him twice. You know, like in his later years when he had to kind of go on tour because all his money had been stolen and all that. It was just amazing. He was so amazing. So, yeah, I could have had... Yeah, but that particular one, well, I kind of... It hints at something, isn't it? It's just really beautiful and beyond words.
So you were in Sheffield?
Yeah.
Starting to work for the centre?
Yes, so I started part-time working for the centre, I don't know when, maybe 2011, when Vajratara was talking about leaving, I went to talk to her about maybe I could do what she did in the office, and she said, oh, well, she didn't do much in the office, but maybe I could be one of the women's literature conveners. Which completely, I thought, really? Anyway, I was. So with first of all, with Shanta City, and then with Zyapon. So and for quite a long time, I was part-time at the centre. So part-time working in another job and then coming for the afternoon to the centre.
So working hard for the Dom. And then in 2015, you moved into the women's community.
Yes,
so.
I think it was 2015.
Yeah.
At 2015, yeah.
I mean, I remember you saying to, because I was in your Mitch group, I remember you saying, well, if I move into the women's community and I'm working at the centre, then that will be my whole life in Buddhism. Right. That's what I remember you saying.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, all of it. So it's quite a big deal.
Yeah, it's quite a big deal. I was doing the classic 3 C's, I suppose, Living in the community, working in the... my livelihood, dedicated to the centre.
I think we're coming to the next track, actually.
Okay. So I feel like I should know more about classical music than I do, okay? I feel like it's one of those things, isn't it? It's a kind of true rat and banty thing. Improve, get better in your whatever. But I do like classical music. And I do go and see it live quite often, but I never seem to listen to it at home somehow. But this song just stands in a way for all those classical and beautiful, particularly sacred music, actually, that I've heard over the years. And it comes from, I went with Donna Mai for a weekend to New York on holiday, and this was being performed in a church, not in the midst of it, in a church. And it's really beautiful, I think. And it also just represents all that kind of sacred music that maybe I'll learn more about. Maybe if I ever do this again in 20 years or something, I'll know more about it anyway. So, shall we go pronouncing it?
Yeah, we had to ask.
Miss Rarere May Do. Miss Rarere May Do.
Thank you. Miss Rarere
May Do. God have mercy on
you. God have mercy on you.
God have mercy on me.
Well, this is sung, I think it's for Penny. Anyway, it's sung by the choir of Trinity College. We'll play it. Say this one.
Thank you.
Is coming.
Well, we're coming to almost your last. Well, no, it's nearly the last track. So
just one left.
Just one left. 2018, you became chair of the Buddhist Centre. I think you said you were a bit worried about what was going to happen.
My big fear was what would happen when Matty died, actually.
Yeah.
Because I just thought maybe through that one we'd kind of collapse in on itself in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, and that happened in that October of 2018, actually everything had been so well thought through and planned, and in a way I think the order had already gone through so much before then, that it didn't happen at all. In fact, the order was much stronger in a way. So that was the thing I was worried about.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought there might be a pandemic. That would have to
You didn't see that coming.
No, but Daniel did have us organising an event called Build a Contagious Buddhist Centre.
Which we had to cancel.
So contagion at the Buddhist Centre didn't happen.
Maybe it did.
It's happening everywhere. But so you steered us through COVID with we went online. I mean, I remember it being really successful. We just seemed to be utterly seamless. You know, we just, 1 minute we were meeting here, the next we were all on Zoom.
Well, a lot of that was Ayudasa,
yeah.
Working behind the scenes to make all that happen. But yeah, it was. I mean, it did. I did. I think when we knew we were going into lockdown, I can remember just thinking, okay, this is what you're doing, Satchit. This is what you're doing. Do you know what I mean? It just felt like, in a way, I can't put it into words. I suppose it felt a bit like, it's not too grand, but it felt like, this is the thing of your life that you're doing. I think, do you know what I mean? It was just like, it felt, I suppose, like the, something was coming through me, and it was just like all I had to do was turn up and challenge whatever it was, and it would be all right.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, with loads of people doing, or, you know, Ayudasa doing the techie stuff, and then Virunanda as well, but people kind of coming in and doing stuff. But it did feel like I was doing the thing that my life had trained me for so far to do, and that I had help.
And there were some great retreats. I remember, what was that one about the keys for the, what's it called, keys for the...
Oh, the peace poem.
Yeah. For the unhappy prisoners. Or,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So there were some really...
Yeah, well, that was lucky in a way, because in a way, because everything was different, it kind of enabled me to feel much more creative. I just thought, that's my favourite poem. Let's do a retreat on it.
So, this is your last track. Do you want to tell us about your last track?
Okay, so this is a David Bowie song. I had to have a David Bowie song. He didn't write it, and it's a bit obscure, but I just love it. It's just really cheerful. So, and darling, as you're here.
Your heart with love today. Don't play the game of tact. Things that happened in the past only happened in your mind, only in your mind. Oh, forget your mind and you'll be free. Yeah. Writing's on the wall. Free, yeah. And you can know it. If you choose, just remember lovers never lose, cause they are free of thoughts unpure and of thoughts unkind. Gentleness clears the soul, love cleans the mind and makes it free. Dragons have been bled. Gentleness is everywhere. Fear is just in your head, only in your head. Fear is in your head, only in your head. So forget your head and you'll be free. The writing's on the wall. Free, yeah. And you can know it all if you choose. Just remember, lovers never lose, cause they are free of thoughts unpure and of thoughts unkind. Gentleness clears the soul, love will clean your mind and make you free. Yeah.
Okay, so your last track, nearly time to cast you away. Mm-hmm. But maybe you want to. You're standing down as chair in April, and handing over to Bojan Yorga as the next chair. So maybe you want to say a bit about what's happening.
Okay. Yes. So my plan is, having spent 15 years very much, as I said, sand was my main practice. I would really like some time to go deeper in my meditation, because even though on retreat I find meditation really nourishing and I do go deep, I find it difficult in everyday life. So I want to have some time where I just can meditate. So I'm trying to set up my life where I can also have a bit of a rest as well, actually. So I've kind of taken a year away from Sheffield from mid-April. I don't know what I'm going to do. At the moment, you know, I love Sheffield. I can't imagine not coming back. But the whole point, I think, of this going forth that I want to do has to be with an openness. For the year itself, Tara Maitrey's kindly said that I can base myself at her house in Manchester. So I'm moving out of the community, and I'm going to do some retreats, some solitaries, some holidays, see what happens, really. And then I'm completely planning at the moment to come back to Sheffield and be part of the Sangha as ever. But I can't 100% say that, because otherwise, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, it's a bit like I don't know what I'm going to do. It's a bit like I really want to do a big going forth and a big stepping into an unknown in the way that I can. You know, it's like it's not possible. I don't want to take it. I thought in the past one day I'd do a year's retreat. Now, that's not what I want to do now. But it's a bit, I'm trying to find a way where I can have as near to those kind of conditions as I can. and have some nice holidays too. That's my plan.
Yeah. Sounds great. But unfortunately, I'm going to cast you away on a desert island. So, well, maybe that would be. If you're not busy building shelters and stuff. How are you going to cope on a desert island?
Well, I kind of got this wonderful imaginary desert island that's half Mediterranean, half tropical. So I imagine it's going to be full of all this amazing vegetables and fruit, like coconuts and tomatoes and, you know, it's kind of like, and all this like beautiful white sand, beautiful turquoise sea. So as long as temperature's quite mild, I think I'll be fine. Like, I'm not amazingly practical, so if it was a bit difficult, if it was more like a Scottish island, I might be in trouble. Thinking of Lauren's being this like wonderfully Mediterranean island.
Okay, well, I mean, I think classically they're tropical, so tropical. Maybe half of it could be Mediterranean with olive trees. I think
olive trees would be very nice.
Tomatoes and yes. Bananas and coconuts.
Yeah, that would be perfect.
I think we can do multi-climate. So I'm going to give you a copy of the Dhammapada.
Oh.
And you can have.
You're not. Be alright to have a photo chair and have a
photo. Honestly.
Thank you. Nothing wrong with the Dhammapada, but I just love this book.
And you're getting all of Bansley's memoirs. Oh, I didn't bring them all up. So you've got a lot to read.
I hope I don't have to swim from the boat to the desert island. But that's amazing.
So I told her she had all of Bansley's memoirs, and I said, well, you can bring a book. So she said, Well, I do read a lot, so can I have all of Dickens as well as all of Bante? So we've got some Dickens as well.
Thank you.
So I think that's quite generous of you, Elise. And you get a luxury item.
Okay, well, at first, because I love olive oil, so I asked if I could have an olive press to make my own oil, but you said.
I said that's a bit too practical. It's got to be a luxury.
Okay, so I've asked for some prescription goggles for swimming in that beautiful turquoise water.
So you can see the fishes on the reef.
On the reef.
And spot the sharks coming. Okay. So, yeah, so that's us. What track are you getting? If your track's got washed out,
it has to be Fill Your Heart. Okay. The last one.
Just say so.
Bit
bit of David Bowie.
Bit of Dave Bowie, bit of Bizarre.
Yeah. Fill your heart.
Lovely.
Thank you, Sasha Jetty. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for sharing your life story and your tracks.
Hearing other people, it's a real gift that you brought to the
same. Thank you so much. Hear everyone's story. I love the music. Maybe we could have David Bowie to play us out. Do we need to clear the space? It'd be helpful to clear the space. I think, yeah, people don't mind putting their chairs and speaking to David Bowie. Well, it'll be the first and only, probably. They're not.